Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insiders' insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, inside one of the most exclusive and influential clubs in the world, we'll look into the President's Club. Then, on the Scholar Circle, in the face of looming public health and sustainability issues, we'll explore the intersection of science and politics in the U.S. It may be the most exclusive club in the world, and possibly one of the most influential on world politics. The President's Club is a clique of U.S. presidents, past and present. How much do past presidents influence the sitting president on important policy issues? Who do sitting presidents turn to on issues that only a president can understand? With us is Time magazine editor Nancy Gibbs, who looks behind the scenes of this exclusive club for the new book, The President's Club. Welcome, Nancy Gibbs. Great to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So the President's Club, inside the world's most exclusive fraternity, you open the book actually with an intro about how George Washington, even though it wasn't a formal club at that point, how his impact kind of laid the groundwork for this to emerge.
He had a lot of important decisions to make, one of which was whether to even become a former president. There were plenty of people who would have been happy having him be president for life, and his decision to step down after two terms and to therefore establish the precedent of, you know, a peaceful transition of power and limited service was the first most obvious important decision. But then when his successor calls him back into service as commander of the armies, he also established the precedent that former presidents who retain a lot of prestige and stature can be very useful to their successors.
It seems the assertion of the book is really that this President's Club does, in fact, shape history in some ways.
When we first started thinking about this book, we were using the idea of a President's Club as a metaphor, basically, of just the men who either are or have been president and what happens when they get together. The more research we did, the more we discovered that it is a much more real thing among these men than we had realized. It has rules and rituals and protocols. It has souvenirs. You know, at one point, Lyndon Johnson gives Dwight Eisenhower a pair of cufflinks with a presidential seal on them. And he says, you know, you and Harry Truman are really the only two guys who can legitimately wear these. But you notice it doesn't say Democrat or Republican on them. They use the term club with each other. You know, Reagan writes Jimmy Carter a letter that starts out, you know, since we're both members of this rather exclusive club of ours. But what really made us realize how much more real it is was when my co-author, Michael Duffy, discovered there is even a clubhouse in Washington on Lafayette Square across from the White House, an unmarked townhouse that only four men in the world are allowed to check into. They have to call the White House to make reservations, and it is solely for the use of former presidents. So at that point, we realized, yes, it's an idea, but it is also some institution that they are very aware of joining and of the sitting presidents of using as an instrument of presidential power. It's an instrument of power that's not in the Constitution. It's not in any textbook. But every president we studied found some way to use the club to his advantage and often to the country's advantage on missions that really no one else could perform other than a former president.
Yeah, it seemed like the big theme was primarily foreign affairs, though not exclusively. What would you say the most prominent area of policy was that was impacted?
Well, you're right that it usually is foreign policy, and there are a couple of reasons for that. Wouldn't really be appropriate for former presidents once out of office to be terribly involved in domestic policy. But because they tend to have developed very important relationships with overseas leaders, and because of the stature that attends to a former president, there are missions that they can undertake much more successfully than an ambassador or any other emissary. Our story really begins with the most unlikely of all of these presidential pairings, which is Harry Truman secretly mailing a letter, not telling anyone on the White House staff. It's the spring of 1945. He'd only been in office a few weeks. He secretly mails a letter to Herbert Hoover, asking Hoover to come in and talk to him. Now, this is to the horror of the Roosevelt loyalists in the White House who are still mourning Roosevelt's passing. They're suspicious of Truman. And the idea that he would reach out to their mortal political enemy, Herbert Hoover, was just, you know, mortifying. But what Truman understood was that Herbert Hoover, as he told him, knew more about feeding hungry people than anyone alive. He had done it for Woodrow Wilson after World War I. He had been an engineer by training, and this was basically the problem of figuring out how to get food to people in Europe in the immediate months after the war, when there was a risk of mass starvation. That was the problem Truman was facing. And that Hoover, as an engineer, as someone who was really good at complicated puzzles, and with his stature, of course, as a former president, could help persuade countries that had food to get it to the countries that needed it. It was just this enormous sort of jigsaw puzzle. And so Truman basically calls him in. The two men meet. They're very suspicious of each other, but they are both very committed to avoiding what could have been a devastating catastrophe in Europe. So the next thing you know, Truman is sending Hoover to 22 countries, 50,000 miles around the world. He meets with 36 prime ministers and seven kings and the Pope and negotiates all of these deals to move food around and to prevent this mass starvation. You know, that is a classic example of something that a former president could do for a sitting president that exists outside of policy and politics. Didn't matter that Truman's a Democrat, Hoover's a Republican. It was a goal that they both shared.
It's outside of partisanship, but they had to at least agree that they needed to feed the starving people.
And they had disagreements about the value of mandatory food rationing versus voluntary. They're always we're going to disagree about how you execute something. But what we kept finding was that when it came to foreign policy, the President's Club is most useful when there is some diplomatic knot that needs to be untied and a former president is the right emissary to send. Having said that, what really interested us most were not the encounters that were taking place sort of on the world stage or on the public stage. What interested most was when these guys pick up the phone and call each other just because they need to talk. And the relationships that form between them that are based on the scars they all share. And the fact that once you have been in that job, the job changes you. And whatever you thought going into it, you know, the first President Bush told us, you know, you campaign for the office, you think you know what it means to be president. It all changes the day you get your first intelligence briefing. And then you realize what you're up against. So what we found is that it's a very, very, very small circle of people that understands the decisions that you have to make and the burden that that places on you. And they all come out of that office, even the successful ones, even the ones whose decisions turned out well, they all come out of the office with scars. And there are very few people they can talk to about it. That was what really struck us. So these friendships that developed and these partnerships that developed among men who had nothing in common politically, nothing in common personally, but were very tightly bonded just by the experience of having sat in the chair.
Let me remind listeners that we're speaking with Nancy Gibbs, and the book is called The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. Well, let's talk about some more of these relationships. I thought Ike was particularly interesting, President Eisenhower.
He's a very interesting one. He sort of looms very large over the first part of the club's history, and which, of course, makes sense. Here's a guy who was not a politician. The first office he ever ran for was president. No one even knew what party Eisenhower belonged to until the 52 campaign. And he, you know, here's the man who had saved Western civilization. So he was unique in the position he had on the national stage, both going into his political life and then coming out of it. When he was president, he did not have a whole lot of need for advice or help or support from either Truman or Hoover. Many of these relationships we find take a lot of twists and turns. So Truman and Eisenhower had worked very warmly together during Truman's presidency. They really sort of helped build the post-war security structure of the Western alliance. The idea of creating NATO and being able to sell a very suspicious Republican Congress on permanently stationing U.S. troops in Europe, radical idea. Truman knew he would need someone with Eisenhower's stature to help him put in place the kinds of measures like NATO that he was trying to institute. So the two men were really partners until the 1952 campaign. It all comes apart. It just turns into the most virulent kind of blood feud between two guys that basically comes down to Truman feeling like Eisenhower, upon becoming a politician, had become a coward, a political coward, a moral coward, for refusing to stand up to Joe McCarthy. And so the two men have a very bitter split. Truman basically travels around the country. He's not running for re-election. He's not running against Eisenhower. He travels around the country running against Eisenhower, saying the guy's unfit for office. So it's probably not surprising that all through Eisenhower's presidency, there's scarcely a birthday card from the White House. Truman does not step foot back in the White House during the Eisenhower years. But that would be the end of the story, except, again, there's always a twist. So in this case, the two men find themselves together again at a series of funerals. The first is for George Marshall, ironically enough, since he was the one that Truman thought Eisenhower should have defended more faithfully against McCarthy. But they really find themselves reconciled as they're sharing a limousine together, riding home from Arlington Cemetery and the burial of President Kennedy. And of course, naturally enough, they start talking about their own burial plans and about what they think had happened, whether they think the assassination was a conspiracy. There's a sort of a layer of mortality over this conversation, so that by the time they get back into the city, Truman can turn to Eisenhower and say, you know, you want to come in for a drink? And they end up, you know, in the twilight, sitting together at Blair House, having a drink and talking about what they have learned and what they did and what they were up against. And again, by this time, they're both former presidents. They both carry the memories of missed opportunities, things they were proud of and will never get credit for, things they got blamed for that they couldn't have prevented. These are all the experiences that two presidents have. So Eisenhower and Truman end up being reconciled that night, even as these two are reconciling. Lyndon Johnson, who's now suddenly president upon Kennedy's assassination, that night, the night of the assassination, calls Eisenhower, says, I've needed you for a long time. I need you more than ever now. Eisenhower gets in his car the next morning, drives to Washington, comes to see Johnson at the White House. The two men have lunch together. Eisenhower writes out in longhand on a legal pad, here's what you need to say to a joint session of Congress.
I thought that was amazing.
It was amazing. Because again, here you have a...
Yeah, he actually told him you have to
continue,
pull this together.
And, pull this together, right. Yeah. Continue Kennedy's legacy. Kennedy's entire legislative agenda, by and large, was stalled in the Congress. The civil rights and education, the reforms Kennedy wanted to institute were not happening. Eisenhower's advice to Johnson is get up in front of a joint session of Congress and promise stability and continuity and that you are going to fulfill the legacy of your slain predecessor. So you have a Republican former president telling a Democrat to pursue this Democratic agenda that had been unfulfilled. And this is really about Eisenhower's judgment of what the country needed at that time, what the world needed at that time to see stability and continuity coming out of the United States.
It was also remarkable that he practically wrote the speech out, and he wanted Lyndon Johnson to take it on as if it was an act of God putting him in the presidency.
Well, this is the way these guys tended to think. When you are in the position they're in and facing the challenges they face, you know, the stakes are very, very high. And often it helped them. It was a comfort to them to feel that God was watching over them and had their back. And this was something they would often reassure one another of.
One of the things that I thought about with Eisenhower in particular, and Johnson in particular, and what seemed hard to reconcile is that Eisenhower was the president who essentially dismissed the idea of overspending on military, warned against the military-industrial complex, and yet President Lyndon Johnson really escalated that Vietnam War.
Right. You picked up one of the things that really surprised us, because all through his presidency, one of the things Eisenhower was proudest of was avoiding getting into another war. He got us out of Korea. He avoided with Hungary, with Quemoy and Matsu, with Lebanon, one crisis after another, in which there was often enormous pressure to send U.S. troops. And he wouldn't do it. The Suez Crisis, again and again and again. And certainly Vietnam. And he, partly because, of course, of his stature as a great military leader, it may have been easier for him to resist some of these pressures. But one of the things that he was most proud of was that there had been no more, you know, American casualties on his watch. Johnson comes into office. There's a lot of evidence that he's very skeptical about Vietnam and he's calling Vietnam a mess early on. Eisenhower now is sounding much more hawkish about Vietnam than he had when he was in office. And he comes to Washington, you know, Johnson is always calling him. He even would call him and say, could you make up some excuse to come to Washington? Because I really need to talk to you. There was one occasion where Eisenhower actually ran the meeting. You would have thought he was still president, as he is talking about the importance of being clear and consistent and basically using overwhelming force. If you're going to go in, you have to go all in. And he was much more hawkish about Vietnam as a former president than he had been as a sitting president. And I think that carried a fair bit of weight with Johnson. Remember, it's easy to forget now that we know how the whole thing turned out, that in, you know, 1965, 66, what we're talking about, the American public was much more in support. The administration, including holdovers from the Kennedy administration, there was much more consensus about the need to draw a firm line in Vietnam, the fear of dominoes falling, of losing Southeast Asia. That was not a controversial position, but Eisenhower was very much one of those voices, and it was a very influential voice with Johnson.
It's really quite a juxtaposition when you stop and think about that, how he left his presidency and then how he continued his foreign policy in a completely different direction.
Well, he carried a lot of weight, obviously, because of his stature, but where he was very useful was he really did believe, and this is sort of one of the club protocols, that especially on foreign policy, it undermines a president to have criticism, especially coming from a former president. And he refused to do it. So even after the Bay of Pigs, you know, 4 months into Kennedy's presidency, he has this foreign policy fiasco. It's a disaster. The entire world is denouncing U.S. policy. And Eisenhower comes and meets with Kennedy. They spend, you know, an afternoon walking the paths of Camp David. Many people remember those famous photographs of the two men together. And in private, Eisenhower grills him about what went wrong and the decisions he made and how it had all gone so bad. But in public, Eisenhower says, I think it's the duty of all Americans to support our president. And he privately warns Republicans in Congress, no witch hunting. We need to move on. And again, this is partly because when they were president, they did not like having shots taken at them by former presidents. But even more, when you've been president, they all have this feeling that the United States needs the presidency as an institution to work. They need it to be strong. They need the president to be able to speak with real authority. And so they are very, very careful about anything that could undermine the presidency itself. That can be a line to walk. If you think the president's policies are wrong, how do you, you know, criticize a policy without hurting the office? We see this to this day, where just a couple weeks ago, George W. Bush comes out. He's been very, very quiet for the last 3 years. He said, you know, when he left office, that President Obama deserves my silence. But just a few weeks ago, when he's asked about, would you have done anything differently? You know, he, of course, hopes that the tax cuts that bear his name will be continued. But then he says, he catches himself and he says, but I don't think it is good for our country to undermine our president, and I don't intend to do so. And that is as clear a sort of statement of the protocol as anyone has ever made.
And President Obama, of course, has also carried out the legacy of not pushing a prosecution of anybody from the Bush administration, too. So there's that sort of deference for the office of the president.
We've seen again and again of the times where presidents most often act against their own self-interest or their party's interest tends to be when they think there is something that is damaging the presidency. So this is how you have Gerald Ford trying to cut a deal to avoid a whole Senate impeachment trial of Bill Clinton. It's not because Ford was so eager to have Clinton get off without a problem. It was because he thought that entire spectacle would be damaging to the prestige and the power and the stature of the office. And that's what he was trying to avoid. And we see this in the 1960 election, incredibly close election. A lot of people are telling Richard Nixon to challenge Kennedy's victory. And both Eisenhower and Herbert Hoover, two Republican presidents who didn't like Kennedy at all, didn't want to see him in the White House. But they both counseled Nixon not to press the challenge. They say it would not be good for the country. A lot of countries around the world are looking to the United States as an example. Countries in the post-colonial age are figuring out what form of government to embrace. We don't want a spectacle of anything other than a smooth transition of power at this time.
Does this help explain why Vice President Al Gore didn't challenge the election results? It's really I can't even call them election results because it was not really the exact election result.
I think it was very much a part of it. And I think Gore was someone who was steeped enough in these institutions and these traditions that he had a choice to make about, you know, what he believed at the time. And since then, we've had the recounts and we know that actually, you know, we know how it turned out. But at the time, even though Gore had grounds to feel like it had unfolded in a way that was unfair or unjust, that the cost to the country, the cost to our institutions was going to be too great. One of the things outgoing presidents warn the new guy is you are only going to make hard decisions. All the easy decisions get made lower down the food chain. A decision that makes it to your desk, by definition, is a hard one, or else you would not be the one deciding it. And it means that there's a really good argument for going either way. That's what makes a decision hard. And so whichever choice you make, and again, even if it turns out to have been a good one, there are always reasons to regret the road not taken. And you know, really good arguments for either side. And this is one of the reasons why the office is so difficult to carry. And it's why you come out of it regretting even successful decisions, much less the unsuccessful decisions. But even the successful decisions often still come at a cost of human life, come at a cost of suffering or dislocation or difficulty to people. And so this is something that, you know, it is so much a part of the job to make these hard choices. You know, President Clinton said there's this just natural sympathy we have for each other because of what we went through.
Right. It is quite fascinating. One of the most interesting aspects, I thought, was that President Carter was a misfit from beginning to end, even within the presidential club.
Isn't that funny? He could both be, as he has said, and as many people have said, a more successful former president than he was a president. He's done amazing work around the world through the Carter Center in relieving terrible diseases, in promoting democratic elections around the world. And yet, just as he was sort of a loner in office, he's a loner out of office. There's a famous picture from 2009, right before President Obama's inauguration, where President Bush invites the whole club to the White House for lunch. And you have a picture of all five men standing in the Oval Office, and there's Carter sort of off on his own. It is not as though the guys had just been having some big fight about policy. We talked to President Carter about this. He says, you know, we were talking about what it's like to live in the White House. And of course, interestingly, a lot of those men could help President Obama with what it's like to raise daughters in the White House. President Carter, President Clinton, President Bush, all had daughters as the Obamas do. And so, you know, how do you keep this very strange life you're going to be living from making your family life impossible? But yes, Carter was both someone that his successors called upon because he could be very useful to them. He solved some of these thorny diplomatic problems, but he also has a way of thinking he knows better and would not always stay on script. And so you would find the president's kind of agonizing. At one point, Bill Clinton says to George Stephanopoulos, you know, I was going to send Carter. You think that'll be okay, don't you? Because they think, on the one hand, he may be the only guy who can get the job done. On the other hand, you never know what exactly he's going to say or do. He was a very interesting sort of outlier character. But one of the things I've been reminded of, we're at the 1-year anniversary of the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. Carter obviously had to deal with his unsuccessful attempt to rescue the hostages in Iran. In both cases, you had very hard presidential decisions, you know, very high risk, very high stakes, very difficult, rather separate from whether the mission succeeded or not. So I couldn't help but thinking in these last weeks, what if Carter's effort had turned out differently? What if President Obama's effort had turned out differently? And ultimately, these are not the guys flying the choppers. So in terms of the willingness to make a brave, difficult, risky decision, they're very similar. Sometimes the decision goes well, sometimes it doesn't. I think it is a reminder again that even though no one is sort of allowed to complain about being president, you know, you've spent often much of your life and certainly the previous years before becoming president campaigning for the office and fighting like mad to get it. You're not allowed to say, boy, this job's a drag. But if you look in the diaries and you look at the phone calls and you look at the letters, you will hear these presidents basically saying that there's a lot about this job that is really hard and really difficult. And the only guys that they can really talk to about it who will not sort of say, well, quit whining, are the other guys who've had it, both because they know and because they know there isn't really anyone else they can talk to about it.
Right. And then there's this aspect of how, and you've shown it in many of the relationships, there are points where they're very icy and there are points where they're not so icy. And Clinton and Carter was one of those examples where it was icy for a bit until North Korea.
And, you know, here's a classic case where at a period where tensions were rising between the U.S. and North Korea over North Korea's nuclear program, and there was a real risk of even military confrontation. And so Clinton sends Carter to go basically on what was meant to be a sort of intelligence gathering operation to assess what North Korea's intentions were and whether we needed to proceed with very tough economic sanctions or potentially military action. So Carter goes over and he meets with the North Korean leader. And not only does he not just assess intentions, he ends up cutting a deal that would allow UN inspectors back into the nuclear sites and avoid the imposition of sanctions, which you would have said was a great diplomatic breakthrough, except for the fact that Clinton and his national security team heard the details about it when Carter went on CNN to announce his breakthrough. So on the one hand, if you're sitting around in the White House, are you thinking, oh, great, he cut a deal, or oh, my God, I think the word treasonous was used at the time, and words I can't use on the radio. It's a classic case where Carter was able to very successfully untangle a really tough diplomatic knot, but did not exactly go by the rules that the first person you brief about any of your missions is your commander-in-chief.
Do you get a sense that this President's Club is part of what helps us understand continuity? So, for example, President Obama had made some promises about foreign policy in particular that are, Guantanamo Bay being one of them, not being fulfilled. Do you get a sense that that's partly as a result of this club and the relationships that have developed and the advice that goes back and forth?
I don't know that it's about the advice, but it is about something that is a key characteristic of the club, because it's a key characteristic of the presidency. And it's one of the reasons why presidents tend not to criticize each other. And it is that, of all people, Daniel Ellsberg of Pentagon Papers fame told Henry Kissinger after Nixon was elected in 1968, so Kissinger is now going to be coming into the inner circle. And it's Ellsberg who says to him, you know, once you are in that circle, and you are now have access to the most highly classified information, the president and his very closest national security advisors, and you see what we really know, and you see what threats we really face, it completely changes the way the world looks, and it changes the kinds of decisions that you make. I think it's probably safe to say that what candidate Obama knew and believed was wise or possible regarding national security changed dramatically when he became President Obama and was getting those briefings himself. This, again, is not to say the presidents should suspend their critical faculties or do whatever the generals or the spooks tell them. But the world does look very different when you know everything. And so one of the things that we kept hearing, even from President Bush Sr. about President Bush Jr., was when he would not criticize. It was not just that he would not criticize his son. He would say, I'm not read in. I don't know what he knows. I don't have all the information that he's acting on. John F. Kennedy said, no one has the right to judge a president unless they know what crossed his desk, unless they know what information he based his decisions on. And very often, we only have that information 10, 20, 50 years later with the declassification of documents. The presidents are very mindful that outside of that inner circle, we don't know what we're talking about.
Well, let's end on a lighter note. You described two presidencies, Bill Clinton and Bush, as Oscar and Felix of American politics.
I think it's fascinating alone that we had father and son presidents in our lifetimes. The fact that the president in between also became a member of the Bush family. Barbara Bush has talked about her husband as being the father that Bill Clinton never had. Clinton never knew his father. He became very close, particularly to the first President Bush. The rest of the family has a nickname for him. They call him their brother from another mother.
I thought that was very funny. The son, President George W. Bush, had a quote, and you named a title after it. Tell 41 and 42 that 43 is hungry. I think that's what it was.
Well, I believe it was at the opening of Clinton's library. Presidents take presidential libraries seriously. They consult each other about them. They commiserate over having to raise money for them. They appear at the dedications. They even talk about, you know, where they're going to be buried at their libraries. In this case, the first President Bush and President Clinton had wandered off and were talking, and so 43 was sent off the message. Tell 41 and 42 that 43 is hungry. I think at one point the Bushes had baseball caps made of 41 and 43.
Oh, that's great.
They're very conscious of where they fall in comparison to one another, of where they fall in history, of the continuity amongst them. And those are the sorts of things, you know, again, where they are very aware that they are members of a very, very exclusive club. They don't talk about it publicly, but they certainly consult each other privately. They're always being approached to support causes or to appear at events. And so their staffs are in touch with each other all the time. They're very aware of, are you going to do this? Are we going to do this? What do you think? Shall we all agree to do this national service, public service announcement together? Okay, yes, I'm in. Are you in? You know, they really do operate that way on many occasions. And since we're so used to looking at presidents as individuals, we thought we could come to a very different understanding of them, both as human beings and of this office, by looking at them together.
The book, again, is called The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity, and we've been speaking with Nancy Gibbs, who is the co-author of the book. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Throughout the past decade, intense battles have escalated over public policies to address public health and sustainability issues, including climate change. Within the policy argument, several important questions have arisen about the intersection of politics and science. How does one maintain the integrity of science? What about the politicization of science? How do democratic processes impact the work of science and public understandings? Three experts join us. Naomi Oreskes is professor of history and science studies at the University of California in San Diego. She is author of numerous publications, including The Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco to Global Warming. David Gustin is professor of political science and co-director of the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes at Arizona State University. He is author of Between Politics and Science, Assuring the Integrity and Productivity of Research, and also co-author of Informed Legislatures, Coping with Science in a Democracy. Mark Brown is professor of government and political science at California State University at Sacramento. He is the author of Science in Democracy, Expertise, Institutions, and Representation. David Gustin, in your book, you had a quote from Science and Reason arguing about how democracy depends on the use of reason. And if the integrity of science and reason are undermined among the majority, then democracy itself is in peril. Do you agree with this? And if so, why?
You're really starting with a tough one. I think that there's a close but sometimes problematic relationship between democracy and reason. And on the one hand, it's challenging to figure out how we get to a good, solid, robust democratic politics without a great deal of both reason and reasonableness. On the other hand, we have historical legacies of what had passed as reason and reasonableness that do not stand to our current democratic sentiments. And therefore, we might want to scrutinize what currently stands as reason and reasonableness to see whether those can pass our democratic sentiments as well. If that's the case, then yes, we need reason and reasonableness, but we always need to be reflexive about what those things mean, try to understand them both historically and currently, and look beyond them to things that are values and sentiments as well.
And science itself? Where does it play in, along with reason, reasonableness, and democracy?
Well, science is a critical component of liberal democratic societies in lots of different ways. It helps create the material basis for a good society. It provides, in many instances, a model of the application of reason and reasonableness that democracy can draw on for solving some political problems. But it's also an enterprise that is rather exclusive compared to our aspirations for democratic activities. And it operates in some ways that really don't stand a favorable comparison if we want to think about how we want democratic institutions to operate.
Naomi Oreskes.
I guess I have a slightly different view. I think reason is central to science, the evaluation of evidence, the evaluation of claims, the scrutiny, the critical scrutiny of claims is at the core of all scientific research. And I agree that science is essential for democracy in terms of giving us evidence about the natural world we live in, giving us some constraints. There are physical constraints on the world we live in. There are laws of physics and chemistry. There are material constraints. And science plays a crucial role in our understanding those constraints and understanding what they mean for how we live and how we operate. But when it comes to the political domain, I guess I've been pretty influenced by Drew Weston's work and just life experience. Politics really isn't about reason, not really. It's really about values, it's about feelings, it's about emotions, it's about the things we love and value the most. Most of us don't vote on principles of reason. We vote on principles of values, and we vote to protect the things we care about. And sometimes we even do that in highly irrational ways because we don't always sort that out very well. But that's the reality of how people do behave. So I think it's really important for all of us who are in this kind of interface between science and politics to recognize that difference and to say that when it comes to politics, it isn't just about reason. I mean, we hope reason plays some role, but we know that it's a lot less than most of us academics would like it to be. And we have to acknowledge that. And I think this is really where the scientific community faces a gigantic challenge. And I think it helps explain why the scientific community has been really rather ineffectual in communicating what it knows about the physical constraints, what it knows about the natural world, because scientists talk in the language of reason. They talk in the language of facts and numbers and figures and charts and graphs and all those things, but that just doesn't mean anything to most people. So the trick, and I think this is where, you know, we have a big challenge ahead of us, a challenge that we don't have a lot of time left to sort out on the issue of climate. The challenge is to take the facts of science, the physical constraints, the reason-based stuff that we know, and communicate that in ways that people understand emotionally and their value sense. And that means, in a way, translating the science into what it means for people. So one of the things I'm involved in right now, I recently joined the board of directors of a group called Protect Our Winters, which is trying to mobilize the winter sports community on climate issues. And when we talk about what we're doing, we try to emphasize this is about protecting something that we love. It's about protecting winter sports that are so fun, about the incredible natural beauty of winter in the mountains, and really kind of tapping into people's love of nature, love of skiing. That's, in a way, the personal message. It comes from science, because science tells us that our winters are threatened, but we don't talk about it in the language of science.
Mark Brown.
I would agree with everything that Naomi and Dave just said, except perhaps what Naomi said about values, because I think it's important to remember that there are different kinds of reason, and there's scientific reason, which plays a big role in democratic politics, but people often make reasonable arguments about what's valuable. And in that sense, values are different than preferences. Sometimes I ask my students what kind of ice cream they prefer, and one says chocolate and the other says vanilla, and then I ask the first to persuade the second that chocolate is really better, and they can't.
Right.
Because that's a question of preference. But if I ask about whether the death penalty should be banned or whether we should spend more money to reduce carbon dioxide emissions, that's a question on which people can give reasons. And science is one kind of reason, but there are other reasons about moral responsibility and historical legacy and the kind of society we want to have. And I think democracy works best when you have a constant dialogue between different kinds of reasons on the one hand, and then people's preferences and desires on the other.
One of the things that I was hoping to get to with this discussion is where science and politics interact. I think something David Gustin has written about is this idea of science in the public interest, and that science is supposed to, as we idealize it, advance aspects of humanity. But there are, of course, all these places where science gets politicized, and then that ends up affecting politics and science together. Let's talk about the intersection and how this relationship has changed over time. David Gustin, why don't you start?
The challenge of talking about the politicization of science in part steps from what understanding of science we have to begin with, and to what extent we believe that politics is, in fact, part of science. And I know that Mark and I have subtle disagreements over this. They're very subtle. But I tend to think of science as, in many ways, being political already. And so to talk about a politicization of science is not quite the right way to go, in my view. I mean, the ways that science is already political include the fact that science receives its resources, the ones that it operates with, through political means, that scientists use ways that we would recognize as very familiar in political institutions for making decisions that scientists believe are scientific decisions. So in lots of places, for example, scientists vote, and the result is something that's called science. And so the question to me is not really how do we not politicize science, or how do we keep science from being politicized, but rather how it is that we democratize science because it's already politicized.
Naomi Oreskes, this is going to get batted to you partly because of your latest book, The Merchants of Doubt, in which you detail evidence that science and scientific evidence has been kind of turned on its head in the political process. And the result seems to be a public problem in terms of mostly health and sustainability.
Right. So this is an important point. As you say, this is essentially the topic of our book, Merchants of Doubt, which I wrote with Eric Conway. I think David's right that this is a subtle and complicated issue, and language and nuance does matter here. So I agree with David that the word politicization is somewhat problematic, because, as David says, there is a way in which science is political, especially if the funding is coming from taxpayers. We support science for reasons which are at least in part political. So there's a way in which the word politicization isn't so helpful. So in a way, what I think about in a way is, I don't know, maybe less nuanced. One is political interference. I mean, we know that there are certain processes that go on within the scientific community, certain processes of evaluating evidence, judging claims, publishing them in literature that's peer-reviewed. And those processes, they've changed over time, but there's a certain kind of stability to at least a big chunk of them. And what we have seen in recent years on certain issues, such as climate change and other environmental issues like acid rain and the ozone hole that we talked about in our book, is really direct, overt, kind of vulgar political interference in that process, attempts to distort the peer review process. I mean, I feel the most important chapter in our book is the chapter on acid rain, actually not the chapter on climate change, because we were able to document in black and white with evidence, with historical documentation, the direct interference in the political peer review process. And because peer review is really at the crux of scientific evaluation of claims, that kind of interference, that kind of vulgar, overt interference is really deeply disturbing in democracy. Because if we can't count on peer-reviewed scientific evidence to be reliable because it's been messed with for political reasons, then we do have a deep, deep problem. So I think political interference is significant. And then the other thing we talk about, of course, are politically motivated attacks, which are camouflaged or disguised as scientific attacks. So this is, in a sense, the crux of our book that we show in a whole series of episodes over the last, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, that one of the strategies that people have used in political debate in the United States is to attack science for reasons that are largely political, that have to do with values and interests and all those good, normal political things, but to disguise those attacks as if they were scientific debate. And that's a really toxic thing, both for science and for politics, because it makes it very hard for scientists to know how to respond, because they'd like to respond as scientists to legitimate scientific questions. So they're kind of hobbled when politics is disguised as science. And then it's really difficult for all of us in the rest of the world, because we'd like to know that the scientific information we're getting is accurate and reliable, so we could make those preference and value decisions that Mark was talking about. But if we think that the science is uncertain because people have convinced us of that for political reasons, you know, then we're stuck in this horrible muddle that is really difficult to get out of.
Naomi Oreskes, with regards to what you just said, one is, you said because of politics or values, it seemed to me from the reading of your book that it was really more about money in most of these cases, the cigarette companies, for example, the fossil fuel industry, and not particularly values, that they were using scientific method to try to poke holes in the science.
Well, you know, a lot of people have that reading of our book, and sometimes I feel like maybe this was a failure on our part. We didn't make this clear, although I thought we really did. But I think we were trying to say in the book that it was both money and values. It was money and ideology. Certainly money played a big role, particularly in the start of the story when the tobacco industry first gets involved in this story. For the tobacco industry, absolutely positively, it's about money. It's about the billions of dollars in profits vested in the tobacco industry. But part of what we thought was interesting about the story was that it wasn't just about money. Because if it were just money, it wouldn't have explained why you get prominent scientists who participate in this activity. So what we showed in the book, what we tried to explain, was that there's also this strong ideological component that's driven by the defense of free market capitalism. And it's that ideological component that helps to explain why all kinds of people make common cause with the tobacco industry, people who you wouldn't think on the face of it would think that the tobacco industry was their friend.
Mark Brown, in your book, you looked at the historic perspective of science and politics and also a little bit of a comparative perspective. How do you see this interaction now, and where does it seem like it's going?
I think that Dave Gustin's right that in some sense, science is always organized in a political way, and politics is one of those words that people always mean and use in different ways, so it's sometimes hard to know how people are using it. But it's certainly true historically that science has been shaped by politics. But when it works best, it's shaped in such a way that it is simultaneously somewhat insulated from politics. And that's where I'd completely agree with Naomi's concerns about the way that science has been subject to partisan manipulation, and maybe partisan influence would be more clear than political influence. And that's a major problem because it makes it impossible for science to inform politics. But at the same time, I think we have to also turn the question around and ask, well, what's the best way for science to influence politics? To not just look at the influence of politics on science, but also ask, well, how should science influence politics? And I think historically, and especially in the last 20 or 30 years, there's been a really strong effort to try to have science speak with a single voice and try to provide decisive answers to political questions. And I think that often backfires because then it makes it very easy to undermine the political case for some policy goal by simply attacking the science. If science is offered as the main justification for doing something, then you're practically inviting people to attack the science.
Does democracy sometimes interfere with science when, say, if people don't understand science and they elect representatives who don't understand science, then do those representatives discount the science without understanding it? Dave Gustin, maybe we should throw that to you.
Let me start off by saying, I have been arguing for the democracy side of it, but it's also the case that we have an imperfect democracy. We don't live in a society, and I don't think perhaps anyone on the planet lives in a society that they would call a perfect political democracy. And a lot of the flaws of our democracy seem to correspond with many of the flaws in the relationship between politics and science that we've been talking about. I love Naomi's work, and this is the question that's sort of about it that arises for me, is the bulk of the cure for these pathologies that are documented around climate issues in particular, is the cure for this a situation where, on the one hand, as many in the scientific community pose, one where scientists have more influence, where more scientists are elected to public office, where we are held to higher standards in including sound science or the best available science in our regulatory and administrative decisions? Or, and maybe it's not an or, maybe it's an and or, the cure to this in trying to figure out how large, wealthy, partial institutions like the tobacco lobby play a smaller role in the way we deliberate?
That's a very good question.
I think the Koch question of the cure is extremely complicated, and since Dave's read the book, he knows that at the end we don't really try to suggest a cure because that would have been a whole different book. But I certainly don't think the cure is simply to have more scientists in control. I don't think history really supports that. Scientists are good at doing what they do, which is science. And I think that to the extent that we can think about social or regulatory reforms, those reforms should be, as much as possible in a realistic way, to allow scientists to do science as much as possible, protected from gross overt interference. And it doesn't mean that the funding shouldn't be highly scrutinized by the democratic process. It doesn't mean that the topics on which scientists work on shouldn't be highly scrutinized. They should be in a democracy, in any environment. But when scientists are evaluating data, to the extent that it's possible to protect them from political interference. And then the whole issue of funding, and we've talked already about the tobacco industry. I mean, there are some fairly simple things that you could think about. There's a lot of good industrial funding of science. We wouldn't want to say that just the fact of industrial funding is necessarily a bad thing. But there are certain kinds of protections that a person could imagine. So in my own university, it's pretty easy to say, look, it's fine to take money from industry so long as you're free to publish the results no matter where the chips fall. The problem starts arising when people, for example, at the medical school have agreements with pharmaceutical companies to fund research, but if the research is not favorable to the drug or if the research reveals bad side effects, that data can't be published. That's the serious problem, and we know that kind of thing goes on. So I think one wants to think about those kinds of mechanisms to protect scientists, to be able to do good science, to make sure good science is published. I also think, I've thought a lot about industrial research. There's a lot of data in industry that's relevant to public safety and health, that we can't get hold of because it's considered trade secrets. But if those things are about products that are on the market, one could imagine a regulatory structure that makes it illegal to hide scientific information that has, you know, public health consequences. So, again, one could think about political strategies. And I don't think what we want to say is, oh, we need more scientists, you know, in public office. The historical track record of scientists and engineers as presidents, we have to say, is not that great. Right?
So we have a couple of things on the table here. One is scientific integrity and protecting that. One is, of course, this role of experts and the role of democratic laypersons and representatives. Where are we headed now with some of this in the public? David, thank you for the poll that showed the public really wanting scientific debate. And at the same time, we see a lot of decisions on local levels trying to strip science out of public schools or balancing it with things that are not scientific, such as religion. Mark Brown, that was a long treatise. Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's fine. We have a lot of issues here. I could say something more about the whole question of public understanding of science. It's certainly an important piece of the puzzle, but I think oftentimes in these discussions it becomes overemphasized. And I think it's useful to distinguish between scientific knowledge that's politically relevant and that is actually necessary for people to get involved, and knowledge that's not so relevant. The latest numbers I saw, 25% of Americans don't know that the Earth goes around the sun, and I think that's unfortunate, and it should be changed, but it's not going to mean the downfall of democracy. And what research also shows is that scientific knowledge is not actually the most important factor that shapes whether or not people get involved in environmental issues, for example. It's one factor, but more important is people's knowledge of how the political process works and of where they can get involved, and their knowledge and understanding of the politics of science rather than scientific facts taken in an isolated way. And we so often see these worrying studies about what the public knows and doesn't know about science, but I'd like to see a lot more attention given to what the public knows and doesn't know about the politics of science and about how they can get involved, because that's really what shapes whether people do get involved or not.
David Gustin.
One way of taking Mark's comments about getting people involved and interested in the parts of science and the politics of science that are relevant to them is to have really sort of important, provocative public discussions about those things. And I'm part of a group called Science Debate that has been agitating to do just that, to have the presidential candidates engage in face-to-face, publicly televised debates about science and science policy issues. And in 2008, before I was part of the group, they succeeded in having candidates Obama and McCain address in print a series of 14 questions, the answers to which the campaigns published in Science magazine. But the ultimate goal is to get whoever the Republican nominee ends up being and President Obama in a face-to-face debate to talk about science and science policy issues. And there's a public opinion poll that's been circulating that Science Debate was part of that suggests that this is what the American public would like to see also, more so than debates about, for example, faith.
Naomi Oreskes, we saw in the polls when people are asked if they'd like to see the science more in the debates are very high. We also saw in the polls a big drop in the public's confidence in science and scientists after ClimateGate.
Right. It's really, in a way, heartening to know that people are interested in science and would like to hear about how it affects their lives. And that suggests that scientists can play a role in public debate by getting out into the community, talking to people, talking about what they know and how these things are relevant to people's lives. I think Mark is right that it's not about the fact. It's not so much that the problem is that people don't know that the Earth goes around the sun. Although I have to say, I do find that kind of alarming, because if it seems like if they don't know that, then we're really starting at a pretty basic level. It tells us that at minimum we have a heck of a lot of work to do. But at the end of the day, it isn't so much about the facts. I think it's about the process. To me, the efficacy of the stolen email affair, the fact that certain things taken out of context had such power and potency, shows that people really don't understand how science works at all. Yeah, the issue of recalcitrant data is a really great one. I teach it all the time because it's a great way to show students how scientists deal with evidence and to show students how the scientific process works. But the fact that that was taken out of context in a way to discredit science, when actually it's to the credit of science that they grapple with data in this really rigorous way, really tells us that the American people have no idea what scientists actually do, how they work, how the process operates, what the outcomes are. I mean, it is a messy process. It is like sausage making. Seeing what actually goes into it is kind of, in a way, horrible. You know, and scientists are people like everybody else. They get jealous and they get angry and they say stupid things. But somehow out of that process, we still get reliable knowledge. So I guess my message would be that if the scientific community is going out to talk about these issues, that it's extremely important not to just get super hung up on the facts, not to get hung up on how many watts per meter squared we've added to the atmospheric radiative balance, but rather to talk about how do we know these things? How do we know that climate change isn't just caused by the sun? Because we do know that. We have really robust data that tells us that greenhouse gases are driving climate change. In fact, we have really robust data. Climate change would be worse were it not for other pollutants in the atmosphere. But I find when I speak in public, people are really, really interested in that. And people are incredibly grateful when I explain to them, you know, how we know it's not volcanoes. And that would be my message to the scientific community. Get out there and talk more about how we know these things, not just what we know.
I could just add one thing to that. That would also come back to Dave's original comment about science being political. I think Naomi's right that there needs to be more talk about the process of science. But that then also has to include discussion of the political and social process, how science gets funded, the role that it plays in politics, should science give decisive recommendations or present a range of options. And those are also parts of the process of science. And I think if we're going to have more public trust in science advice, scientists need to be much more transparent and open about those elements of the scientific process as well.
Yeah, but if I could add one thing on that, the problem with that is that a lot of scientists themselves don't actually know. So I think that's actually where people like us come in. Political scientists, historians of science, philosophers, people who have studied those processes, we also need to get out and talk about that as well.
And on that note, I'd like to thank you all. Naomi Oreskes is Professor of History and Science Studies at the University of California in San Diego. She is author of numerous publications, including The Merchants of Doubt, How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco to Global Warming. David Gustin is Professor of Political Science and Co-Director of the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes at Arizona State University. He is author of Between Politics and Science, Assuring the Integrity and Productivity of Research. Mark Brown is Professor of Government and Political Science at California State University at Sacramento. He is the author of Science in Democracy, Expertise, Institutions, and Representation. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasian, Melissa Ciprin, Ishmael Karim, and Amanda Vigil, who helped produce today's show. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org and click on the audio archives. You can also keep up with us at scholarcircle.org or armudian.com, or follow me on Twitter at armudian.